and good evening, and welcome to another edition of Bird Calls from Red River Radio, brought to you by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Wally Derleth and Sheila Lawrence are at our phones tonight, and we ask that when you call in tonight, please be patient as we only have two volunteers, and Wally and Sheila may have their hands full from time to time. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he is ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has had since 1997, and he's been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is also the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M University Press, and he has authored more than 80 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife Julie and their two children live in East Texas. And Cliff, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Bill, good evening. Tonight marks our 8th anniversary of this radio show.
I'm 8 years old. I always wanted to be 8 years old again. What a concept. All right. So anyways, had a text there real quick. Cliff is serving as our expert tonight. And once again, if you have any questions to answer tonight, give us a call at 800-552-8502. Also, any photos you would like Cliff to identify must be sent during the show to redriverradio.org to, my email address, wbeckett at lsus.edu. That's wbeckett, B-E-C-K-E-T-T, at lsu.edu. Cliff, at the end of last month's program, you gave us a conservation tip. Could you go ahead and refresh our memories on that?
Yeah, it was regarding construction sites, especially road construction projects, where you're trying to reduce the loss of soil. So you're trying to stabilize the soil, reduce erosion, and you'll see what's called erosion control blankets put down. And there's good and bad with those. There are some that are built better for wildlife and some that aren't. And a study showed that those that weren't put in the ground correctly, laid flat, staked in the corners, didn't do well with snakes. And I know a lot of people don't like snakes, but the way these snakes get entangled, it's a slow and painful death. Nothing deserves to cook in the sun or wait for fire ants to kill you because you're stuck in this erosion control blanket. So it's not a complete sheet of material. Instead, it's a mesh laid flat to the ground. And those that are made of plastic, where each small mesh cell has fixed corners, can be really bad. Snakes get stuck in there. So the best kind of erosion control blankets are those that are made of woven mesh material that are natural fibers that don't have fixed corners, so the cell can flex and move, so snakes that do decide to go through the mesh can get through without getting caught, hung up, and die. And snakes are also important because they keep rodent numbers in check. So we want predators out there to keep pesky things under control. And if you like raptors, things like hawks and eagles and owls, you know, a lot of these eat snakes. So snakes are really important in our environment. I know they get a bad rap. A lot of people don't like them, but you know, I don't go out and pick up snakes. I don't like them, but I leave them alone. They're over there, and that's fine. I don't have to go run over there and look at them, and I certainly don't go over there to kill them. So back to the recap is use those kinds of erosion control blankets that are suitable for what you're trying to do, stabilize the soil, but doesn't in turn kill wildlife.
Yeah, there's a lot of snakes out there that are very, very beneficial. Of course, there's some that you don't want to be near at all.
But that's right.
Even like the black snakes in Florida, they eat other snakes like rattlesnakes.
Yep.
So you want to keep some of those critters around because they also eat rats and other rodents and things like that. It's all a balance of nature.
Yep.
So every month we do a profile species. And what do you have for us this month?
So tonight we're profiling the European starling, a species introduced into North America in the 1800s that now blankets the lower 48 states, much of Canada, and parts of northern Mexico. This is a fairly quiet species that emits many non-musical hissing sounds, gurgles, and simple whistles. We have two sound files to play. First, let's listen to various noises from a busy flock of adult starlings here.
Thank you.
so not very musical. Next file, let's listen to the more familiar and loud begging calls of recently fledged starlings.
You hear the cows in the back,
yeah,
too.
So this is a familiar sound in the summer months, spring and summer, when young starlings are telling mom, feed me, feed me. And that's the begging sound. This species is slightly larger than a bluebird. It's mostly dark in color. During the spring, the adult's bill is banana yellow, and many of their feathers are iridescent purple or green. Immature birds, as well as adults in the non-breeding season, have a dark-colored bill. The initial attempts to release this species into the U.S. occurred unsuccessfully in the 1840s and again in the 1870s. There are some accounts that these were done in order to help control numbers of the pesky Japanese beetle, but the successful introduction seemed to occur in the 1890s in Central Park in New York. An eccentric drug manufacturer named Eugene Schifflin obtained dozens of pairs of starlings from England for release in the name of introducing birds mentioned in the writings of Shakespeare. After its release into the U.S., the species bred successfully and frequently, which enabled it to spread across the continent quickly like wildfire. The first starling recorded in Texas was in Chambers County in 1925. Prior to that, the species was first recorded here in Louisiana in 1907. At the mouth of the Mississippi River, but it was perhaps a local escapee. The first specimen for Louisiana was taken in 1926 in New Orleans. The species was considered rare in Louisiana until the winter of 1932 to 1933, when thousands of individuals appeared in Baton Rouge. Starlings forage on the ground, including parking lots, on mowed lawns, ballparks, and road right-of-ways, in search of insects, worms, and seeds, often along grackles and blackbirds. Starlings congregate in massive flocks, especially during migration and winter, and their communal roosts in winter can tally into the thousands of individuals. The starling nests in all sorts of pipes and crevices on homes and other buildings, plus in tree hollows or cavities that the starling cannot carve on its own, so they often evict nesting woodpeckers from cavities that the woodpecker constructed. Some published accounts state that the very aggressive starling has negatively impacted the red-headed woodpecker in certain parts of their U.S. range. To see a photo of a European starling snapped by James Childress, please visit the Bird Calls page at redriverradio.org.
And this is an example of a starling that happened to nest in between the top floor and my floor, right above my bedroom.
This was
one spring. This was five or 6 years ago.
Yep, and we played this on air when it was fresh.
Yeah.
And it's funny that it took us this long to get to the starling. Yeah. And there's that same sound of the begging young bird, yeah, saying, feed me, feed me, feed me.
And he was right above the vent in my bedroom. So needless to say, at 4:30 to 5 a.m. in the morning, I was,
yeah,
not a happy camper.
They're relentless. Like anything young and hungry, they're relentless.
What do you mean? I'm old and hungry, and I'm relentless.
Same here.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio, and we have phone lines open. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We've already got one caller online, and we had a caller call in with a question, but they didn't want to go online. And the question was, John from Fishville called to say that he heard on NPR that 200 species of birds have disappeared, and he would like you to address this.
Yeah, I heard that as well. That ran around 4:50, 5 o'clock today on NPR. It probably run again or maybe ran previous to that. It was talking about declines in birds. Those haven't completely disappeared. They're heading in the wrong direction. What I thought was interesting was that they were pretty much pointing at climate change, but we've got decades of information on birds that have been declining for that long for habitat loss reasons and, you know, all sorts of other causes of death that are immediate and been happening for half a century. So yeah, that article is interesting on NPR, but I'm not sure we've already been screaming about bird declines for right. decades. So this isn't anything new. It's just a new way of looking at another threat out there, and that's climate change, whether that's, you know, Arctic birds where their landmass is shrinking, if it's altitudinal birds up in the tops of mountains where that habitat shrinking, and so forth, and vegetation changes. If, you know, parts of Texas are going through xerification, meaning drying out and turning into cactus country and really dry areas, and certain birds are pushed out because whatever was there before is no longer there. So there are big changes going on, but that's the one thing I thought of when I heard that is, oh my gosh, we've been screaming for decades about bird declines for all sorts of other reasons. And the sad part is here comes another nail in the coffin, and that's right. climate change.
And he, you know, we have an article up on our website post for this show about two different subject matters. One, Philadelphia has dimmed the skylines after mass collision killed thousands of migrating birds. So our skyscrapers are part
yes.
of the problem.
Yes.
And also a toxin behind the mysterious eagle die-offs may have been finally found. Now, I thought it was DDT, but this article goes on to suggest there are other problems with
things
that we're putting into the environment. So pollution and in chemicals and other problems also play a role.
That's
too.
Right. And the Philadelphia skyline is just one example of a city, and there are several in Texas and elsewhere around the country that are, and we've talked about this. One of our early conservation tips 8 years ago was darkening the skies, dimming lights in skyscrapers. This is nothing new. So we realize that the lights on in buildings often, and especially in foggy or rainy conditions, can confuse birds, and they can fly into it. They're trying to seek refuge, and the light serves sort of as a beacon, and it's to their death because they fly into the glass, or if it's a tower with guy wires, they can fly into that, and it's we know because you go underneath the building and there's a maintenance person sweeping up dead birds because mm-hmm. it's peak spring migration, April 20-something at our latitude here, sweeping up dead birds that flew into the building the night before. And it's horrific, and it's been going on for as long as there have been skyscrapers. So the thought is that if we just turn the lights off, those buildings would be invisible. They wouldn't act as beacons, and the chance of a bird flying into it would be pretty slim. But the lights are attractive to birds. So the idea to darken the skies, the astronomers really want that. We talked about that during our conservation tip. The astronomers love dark skies. They're our best friends with this topic because they want to see the celestial bodies and the planets and everything, right. and they need dark skies. They don't need light pollution from our cities, and birds don't need that light pollution. And the buildings don't need it. If everybody's gone home, what's the point of having all these lights on? We are just wasting electricity, money out of our pocketbooks. It just doesn't make sense.
It makes a pretty skyline for the viewers, and that's about it. But get a painting.
Yeah.
Anyways, that's my suggestion. And also beveling windows like we do in recording studios, where you have the windows actually angled slightly down, will reflect the light down, so they'll be seeing the street when they're coming yeah. straight at it. It's like a mirror. If you turn or tilt the mirror, you're going to see something different. You're not going to necessarily
right.
see yourself, and that could change the pattern.
That's right. And when there's a reflection of the blue sky and the clouds and the trees behind you, the birds don't figure that out. They've got pea-sized brains. They just can't figure it out. Tilting the glass just a slight bit so it doesn't reflect those things that are bird space for birds to fly through really helps.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any questions about birds or our avian world are welcome tonight. We do have one call online, Richard from Jasper. You're on with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question?
Hello, Cliff. I called in a few years ago and talked to you, and you said get a camera and do my homework. So I got the camera, but, you know, I So I studied, you know, a little bit about what the ornithologists were saying about ivory bills. And opinions vary a lot, you know. So it's really hard to really know what's going on with that bird.
Well, so what did you accomplish? You said you got a camera. Did you go out in the woods and get any pictures?
No, that bird is hard to find, and it's really fast. So I don't believe I'm going to be, you know, I'm not speedy enough, and I don't have the legs or the eyes for it anymore.
Right, right. Well, I mean, there's other ways to get bird pictures. Is find out where it's frequenting, set up a bird blind, a photo blind, same thing as a hunter's blind, anything that's camouflage that you can sit there, have a couple of candy bars and soda pops ready, and sit and wait.
Waiting on ivory bills, you'd be there forever waiting on those to come in.
Yeah, you will be eating a lot of candy bars. So I think I'd find another project, Richard. I'd find another photo project. I think there are a lot of extant birds, meaning living birds that are around that you can get really cool pictures of. And in Jasper, actually, Jasper County is one of my favorite counties in all of Texas for birding. It's got all the extremes. It's got the swampiest bottomlands with tremendous forests, and then it goes all the way up to the most xeric sand hills with longleaf and yucca, and it's just everything in between. And I've always said Jasper County and Presidio County, which is all the way on the other side of Texas and the Big Bend country, because I like Presidio because there's not a lot of people, and it's all desert-like habitat, so the bird life is completely different. You get to see cactus wrens and black-throated sparrows, and these riparian areas that are really rare cut through and bring in these neat birds like common black hawk and gray hawk, and it's just magical out there. So anyway, back to Jasper County. You are in a great county for photographing birds, and you just got to figure out how to do it without walking too much, without eating too many of the candy bars in the blind. But man, there you got no shortage of jazzy birds to get pictures of, Richard.
Yeah, I would see a lot of eagles around here and some swallowtail kites out on Bevelport.
Yes,
because it's not all trees there. It's, you know, got some farms out there.
Right. Right.
There's some good places and stuff to see around here.
Yep, Bevelport. Bevelport's
in
a great.
Fact,
go ahead.
Excuse me.
Go ahead, Richard.
I have seen 15 ivory bills, but that's going all the way back to the 80s.
Okay.
And you can find those birds, but it's really, you know, it's really hard. Only once or twice that I've actually snuck up on them, you know, and they didn't spot me and fly off instantly.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's a scary bird, like pileated. They hide behind the trees and they peek at you, and then they just poof, and they're gone. I mean, poof, they're fast.
Well, you've been a lot luckier than me. I've never seen a glimpse of one. I've been in the woods all my life, and I've been to Bevelport. I've put in boats several times in Bevelport, floated down to Forks of the River, because that, to me, is one of the greatest bottomland forests left.
Yeah, that's a pretty place there.
It's amazing. You know, you can get super lost in there. So I remember going back in the days before GPS, and you really had to pay attention, or you were spend the night or maybe several nights because you got lost.
I just use the sun, but that main place where I've been going to, it is just really bad for getting lost. And it's like that. It's a howling wilderness type place.
It is.
And if Bigfoot was alive, he'd be in that place.
He'd be in there too. He maybe could point out the ivory bills, because if those two things are around, that Forks of the River area where you're talking about is really cool place and very difficult to get to, you know, water access, because the land above it on the north side is all private, so only a handful of people would have access that way. So really, it's a public site. But to get to it, you got to do it by boat. So it's just not some place you just show up and take lightly. You got to plan your trip. You probably need to find somebody like you that knows their way around. If you go up Beatrice Slough, you better know which fork to take, because it just all looks the same.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You get in there, it's nothing but trees and more trees and
trees.
Yeah,
that's right. That's right. All right, Richard. Well, thanks for calling back, and keep trying. Keep working on that. Your homework your homework assignment is still on your shoulders. Okay.
we never get rid of homework.
Yeah,
that's right. Life. Thanks, Richard, for calling in. We appreciate it.
Good talking to you.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Red River, Cliff Shackelford, on Red River Radio. And you can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. All lines are open at the moment. And in the meantime, we do have some photos that were sent in. And we're going to go to our first photo here, which was sent in by Rick Mirov, who is here in Shreveport. And he said, last year I called inquiring if it were possible that I spotted a seagull in the shopping center parking lot where I work in Shreveport. Recently, I was fortunate to capture this shot when they returned. Can you verify?
Yeah, and this picture is a ring-billed gull. So the term seagull is a colloquialism. There's no real seagull out there. I mean, we know bird people know what you're saying when you say seagull, but if you open up a book, you're not going to find ring-billed seagull. It's or a group of seagulls. They're just gulls, and terns are related to them, T-E-R-N. But ring-billed gulls are common in our area, or uncommon in our area, in the winter months, the colder months. They come to our reservoirs. Anglers see them. If you cross bridges, you'll see them. And in this case, Rick's picture, they do frequent parking lots where people drop food out of the drive-through, or there's a dumpster. So ring-billed gulls are very opportunistic, kind of like crows, kind of like grackles that we see in parking lots. They're looking for that dropped French fry. So, yeah, neat picture.
Fast food making fat gulls.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
And, of course, around most lakes, even up north, you see gulls of different kinds.
Yeah, we have in North America, there's 15 or 20 species, I bet. Lots. And they're very difficult. I get very confused with gulls. When they're adults, it's one thing, but some gulls take 3 years or 4 years to get adult plumage, and so they look different at age 1, 2, 3. So you have to learn so many different color patterns and feathering. It's gulls are difficult. They're one of my least favorites.
Well, so they do make a mess of the beach, especially if you happen to be laying out on a blanket at the beach, because they don't care where they dump.
Yeah, that's right.
That happens. So you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist. All lines are open right now, and you can get right in at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And our next photo was submitted by Louise Smith, or Smythe, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but she says she really enjoyed the program tonight and that's great news about the Merlin app coming out. She was listening last month. I used the BirdNet one, and I know that it's not all that great and makes a lot of mistakes, but it helps me learn to recognize more common birds. There's something about seeing the little vocal graph that helps me remember the sound better. Interesting. I've been meaning to send you this picture for ID whenever you get a chance. I took it at the Red River Wildlife Refuge about 10 days ago. The Merlin app says it's a worm-eating warbler or a varied bunting, which does seem likely around here. It may not be good enough picture, but I wanted to see what you thought.
Yeah, the Merlin app goofed on her there. It gave her the right grouping, that second entry. It's a bunting. It's a female indigo bunting. And a little brown bird with a pretty stout seed-eating bill. And they really pour through our area in the springtime, and lots of them stick around to breed. I was in the field today, this morning, and heard quite a few indigo bunnings singing around in the forest. So
I'm trying to find where our indigo bunning sound is.
Yeah, I don't know that we have.
Oh, I thought we'd done that. Maybe it was
that
the
one yet.
Okay, well, we got to get to that there.
Yeah, it's on the list.
We got a big list there.
Yeah.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, and you can get right in right now with your calls at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And our next photo is a little bit blurry, but it is on our website, and you can see it. Just go to redriverradio.org and click on the post for Bird Calls. And Tom Crochet, I believe, is how to pronounce his last name. I hope I got that right. A hummingbird appears to be carrying something that has been coming to one of our feeders for a few days. It has a choice of feeders with or without perch. When it is carrying, or maybe always, it goes to the non-perch feeder. I've seen this behavior before, and he wants to know what a bird like that would be carrying.
Yeah, and the picture is super fuzzy. I mean, it looks like it's snapped through glass. That thick Coke bottle glass is what it looks like. And so I can't see what's going on. I have to go with what he's writing about. But for the most part, hummingbirds have very weak feet. They don't use those feet to carry stuff. And the male certainly doesn't, because when there's nest building to be had, it's only the female that builds the nest, and she uses her bill to carry the nest material. So what I had written him, I've seen ruby-throated hummingbirds forage on spider webs. They come up to spider webs and pluck food out that the spider hasn't got to yet, or they'll fly through a spider web, not seeing it, just like you and I walk through spider webs. And maybe that spider web grabbed a leaf, and so I'm thinking that some foul play, no pun intended, is happening there, and it's not deliberate. In other words, the bird is not carrying anything. So I don't know what he's saying. The picture is way too fuzzy for me to make out anything. But if I were to guess, close my eyes and guess what kind of scenario is happening, I think that it's accidental, and it's probably something like what I mentioned with the spider web, and not the bird actually grabbing something.
So sort of like those kids that if you turn your back in school, they'll steal your lunch off your tray, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
Definite a lunch thief.
Well, the spider worked really hard, you know. Yeah. He wove that nest and didn't get that little morsel. So and actually hummingbirds, and again, the females that are working on this, hummingbirds steal a lot of spider web material to hold the nest together. It's super strong material, and so you'll see the females grab it by the bill and swipe the bill side to side to get the sticky stuff off of her bill and onto the nest to kind of cement it all together. So so hummingbirds and spiders have some sort of relationship right there.
All right, and our next photo, by the way, the lines are open right now, so you can get right in at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. This one comes in from Anthony and Dylan. Anthony says, my daughter Dylan, 8 years old, spotted this owl in December in Fairfield, Connecticut. Can you confirm that this is a barred owl?
Cool.
Many thanks.
So a listener from Connecticut. All right. That's a barred owl. Can you scroll down for me so I can see the bird? Yeah, the best feature is the rounded head, no ear tufts, and the coal black eyes. And it's a large owl, about the size of an NFL football. And so those are really the things to look for. And that's the barred owl, the one that we have all over here in Louisiana and Texas as well. It goes all the way up to Connecticut. And a big chunk of the U.S. and makes a lot of hoots and hollers.
And that's Bard, B-A-R-R-D, not Bard as in the Bard Shakespeare.
B-A-R-R-E-D.
E-D.
Yeah, it's referring to the barring or stripes on the bird.
Right, because the first time I heard that, I thought of Shakespeare. And I thought, hey, they named an owl after Shakespeare. Wow, cool. All right, and our next photo comes in, and this is a really nice photo sent in by Chuck Ome. And he wanted to know if this was a Swainson hawk.
It is. It's a Swainson hawk. And I haven't seen this picture. He sent it today, you said?
Yeah. Well, it came in yesterday, but I got it to you today.
Yeah, and I haven't seen it till now. And what's it got in its talons?
Ah, good question. I don't know if that I can
blow that up. Is there any way to zoom in?
Probably not on here.
It caught something that it's eating. So when I get back to my computer, I'll have to zoom in. Because I can't see it at this level.
Yeah, it's got kind of dinner there.
But, yeah, you know, interesting.
Everybody needs a little dinner.
Yeah.
And we also have more information about the Eagle Cam that we've been following along. You had written back, and I got to scroll up here, back about a month ago that you were talking with Louise about this. And you had said you had watched yesterday's Eagle Cam and noticed more than one carcass from an armadillo in the nest. Can't tell if they were road flattened, which means roadkill, already dead, or if the adult brought them in fresh. Armadillos are mostly nocturnal, but I've seen plenty of active during the daylight hours, and I suspect that they're roadkill. Any ideas? And you were asking her.
Yeah.
And she wrote back, the first armadillo showed up the day after the video of the flight happened. I missed how it arrived, but it looked like to be fully intact, and the body tore up the head first and then spent a long time making a big mess of the rest of it. I was trying to make out if it had tire marks on it, but I couldn't tell. Yeah, at that point, I don't think you can. So
yeah, and a lot of roadkill armadillos, and I've seen plenty, aren't flattened. They're in good shape. Armadillos have this crazy way of when they get spooked at the last second, they hop up about 6 or 12 inches. So I think a lot of those end up hitting the bumper and get knocked to the side, and they're not flattened. And they must taste really good. I personally have never tried armadillo, but I noticed that the vultures really get to the fresh armadillos the next morning because they are flocking around the armadillo meat. So it must be tasty. So, and bald eagles are known to scavenge. I've seen quite a few bald eagles in my years on the side of the road eating roadkill deer and other items. And so it wouldn't surprise me if this eagle found a fresh killed armadillo and brought it to the nest.
And by the way, you can see that video on our website in the Bird Calls post for this week. It's at the very bottom after the photos. And it shows about 28 minutes of what's going on in the nest, including eating that.
Yeah, and it says it's recorded May 11th. So it's a month old, and the young eagle has, in this particular nest, only had one surviving eaglet, young eagle, and it's fledged. But a lot of these fledged eagles, once they fly, they still will come back to the nest to sleep on occasion, sometimes for begging for food, but not always. So if you look at the live web today, you might not see anything. So it's cool to go back to these recordings.
And sort of like teenagers, you know, they leave the house and they're on their own, but then all of a sudden they're bringing the laundry in and coming
exactly
back and
bringing
your refrigerator.
And, and want a home-cooked meal for once.
What do you mean teenagers? I still do that. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now. We have lines open at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Anything regarding the avian world and birds are welcome, so please call in now as we have all lines open. And right now I wanted to ask you what the top three killers of wild birds are out there.
Well, we talked about one of them, and that's flying into buildings and wires and things up in the airspace. That's a biggie. Our pet cats, that's a huge one. So we're talking about direct deaths. We're not talking about habitat loss. That's huge. That pushes birds elsewhere, makes them move on. It's no longer suitable for them. So we're talking about direct death. So flying into structures and cats, our friendly feline, that was our very first conservation tip 8 years ago, was keep your cats indoors because they are, even well-fed, they are killers of wildlife, especially birds. So,
and how about, you know, certain pesticides that might affect them and other things, the environmental toxins that we end up putting into the environment?
Well, it's, you know, you have bioaccumulation. If a rat eats a poison and then your cat eats the rat, or a raptor eats that rat, it's usually not good. So an indoor cat is going to live longer. It's going to be healthier. We screened in our porch about 2 years ago, and it has become a, not only utilized by us, but it's also, our cat loves it. And it's you know, you hear about catios where people build these screened in places for cats. Well, ours is big enough that it's great for us. We can get a whole bunch of people in it. So screened in porch is a great way to let your cat get some fresh air, but it also keeps them away from the birds and the lizards and everything else that's needs to be out there, because our pet cats are not natural predators, and our bird life, just they don't know what this thing is that's ready to pounce on them. So Cats a big problem. So keep your feeder out in the open, not right next to a bush. Same thing with your bird bath, because in that thick bush could be a place for the cat to hide and then pounce on your birds that are on the bird bath or feeder. So allow birds to get away. And so that means having open space around it, not right in the middle of the shrubbery where predators can hide and pounce.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we have all lines open right now. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any, picture or question about birds or birding are welcome right now. Sorry, I was checking the email to see if somebody had sent in a picture, and yes, we did get that. Now, our next question that was sent in is, I want to start keeping free-range chickens on my property, mainly for the fresh eggs, but what do I need to know before proceeding?
Wow, that's a great question, and that's really grown in popularity, having chickens to lay fresh eggs. But the first thing you need to know is that everybody loves the taste of chicken. Every predator out there, foxes, coons, possums, snakes, raptors, even your neighbor's dog, your neighbor's cat, everything loves the taste of chicken. So your best bet is to have it in a coop 24/7. There are a lot of people that build these mobile coops where if you have a pretty good yard, you can move the coop after a few days. So if they've made a mess and grazed enough and plucked through the grass looking for bugs enough, you can move it over 20 feet for a new little spot. So, but the key is it's got cage all the way around it, so nothing can get in. So if you want to have truly free-ranging chickens where they're not in a coop, you're going to have problems, and you're going to have a lot of missing friends of yours. They're going to be gone. And again, it's because you've got 15 different predators or more that are out there waiting for that chicken to get a little closer, and tastes good, and I can't blame them. So keep them in a coop. You can keep them outside in a coop. Look online for the mobile coop. That's a really good idea, a really good way to kind of keep the ground fresh and give the chickens some new territory.
All right. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, and still all lines are open, folks. We need some calls out there. Give us a call right now at 800-552-8502, although we always got interesting questions from listeners, and we've actually had three emails so far during this show, which we will get to, by the way, next month. We always take the emails that come in this month and put them on next month's show, so it'll be to turn in.
What'd they say in the Treasure of the Sierra Madre? Questions?
Questions.
We don't need no stinking questions.
I thought that was badges. All right, our new one is interesting. This person wants to get a toy dog, but has heard that hawks and owls will be a problem. What should they do? And alligators, too.
Yeah, a toy dog meaning, palm-sized, little bitty, easy to haul off, really bad idea if you want to take it outside unattended. So what folks can do, of course, is stay close to that dog. Or if you want to let them run, it's going to be like we talked about a minute ago with the chicken coop. It's going to have all sides, and especially a roof, that the dog can run around and not get attacked. Toy dogs, the bigger issue is the neighbor dogs or the loose dogs down the street that fight. So it's not just raptors you're worried about. It's other people's dogs.
Or for that matter, an angry cat that doesn't like dogs.
Yeah,
Because a big cat can really do some damage to a chihuahua or something like that.
Yeah, personally, if I was worried about something else, like a raptor hauling off a dog, I wouldn't get anything that's under, say, 15 pounds. I mean, that's way heavier than what a raptor can pick up. A lot of people say that, I have a 12-pound dog and I think a hawk flew off with it. Well, was it a red-tailed hawk? They only weigh 2 or 3 pounds. They cannot carry 12 pounds. So the math doesn't work. The physics certainly don't work. So probably not a raptor that carried off, but I think you're really safe if your dog weighs 15 pounds or more. So maybe if you have a little dog, overfeed it. How about that? You can get it fat really quick.
Get a bull mastiff. Nothing's going to carry
that's
that
true. Especially the neighbor dogs are not going to mess with it.
Yeah, it might carry your horse off, but that's about it. So, all right, you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and our lines are open at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And I believe it's Cecil. I'm not sure from where is on next. Cecil, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Yes, thank you. It's Alto, Texas, where I'm from.
Okay.
My question is, how do these buzzards locate the carcasses, the food they eat?
Yeah.
Is it smell? Is it vision?
Yeah.
I've been curious forever.
That's a good question. And I drove through Alto the other day. I had to drive 69 up through Wells all the way to Rusk. So I drove through Alto just Saturday it was. So anyway, and I'm disappointed that Alto years ago lost the Dairy Queen because that was always a good stop. But it's been gone for, 8 or 10 years?
For sure.
Yeah. Anyway. Buzzards, we have two species of buzzards, the turkey vulture and the black vulture. The turkey vulture, the one with the reddish head, uses olfaction, which is sense of smell. So yeah. You're right, what you said. They do that species uses smell. And they've done studies where they covered the meat up where they couldn't see it, but it really smelled, and they still homed right in on it. The black vulture doesn't use smell. They use sight. So they will see prey like the dead deer on the side of Highway 69 north of Alto, but they'll also cheat. They'll look to see where the turkey vultures are circling that were alerted by smell. So they'll use that sight not only to see the dead thing, but also to see what their cousin, the turkey vulture, is homing in on. So you've got one of each. You've got the turkey vulture using smell, the black vulture using sight.
All right. Well, that makes sense because I see them on my when calves are born, after birth left behind, they come right to it. And I was just curious, and I see them on dead carcasses, and they seem to find them from great altitude.
Yeah,
I was just wondering about smell or sight.
Yep, that's
right.
So it's a little bit of both depending on the species, and in Alto you've got both species for sure, black and turkey vultures.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that information.
Okay. Thank you, Cecil.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, and we do have lines open now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. John from Fishville, you're calling back. Please hang on the line. And we've got Sheila from Jefferson right now. Sheila, what's your question for Cliff?
Hey, Cliff. I heard a talk not too long ago talking about the evolutionary part of birds, and that birds are one of the closest living relatives to dinosaurs today. And she really got in and started talking about their breathing and how they've evolved to breathe. And I was just really fascinated about that. I know quite a bit about people breathing, but not that much about bird breathing. And I looked it up, and it's just, I'm still trying to get my head around how this works, because they have obviously evolved to be incredibly efficient breathers and being able to meet their oxygen demands. And so anyway, I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Well, that is not my expertise, Sheila. And the herpetologists love to remind bird people that birds are just glorified reptiles, and so they're not really anything unusual. They're just herps. They're lizards. They're snakes. They're relatives of those. So I laugh when I hear that. But no, when it comes to that kind of physiological question on breathing, I don't know. I'll have to look it up, just like you. What's also interesting is birds have air sacs. Did you read about that when you?
I did, and I'm still trying to get it in my head around how that works on a physiological.
Yeah,
basis.
And I'm not an expert on air sacs and how they inflate and are they all connected or what. So that's a good question, and I should read up on that. So you've given me a homework assignment, Sheila.
There you go.
So let's the two of us try to figure that out, maybe have an answer in the next month or two. But that's an interesting one. So where did you hear? Was this a podcast that you heard about? Heard all this?
She did, I think it was on a TED Talk.
Okay.
And she was talking about evolutionary, I think she was an evolutionary biologist.
Okay.
And her talk was about, you know, how birds have evolved to breathe. And so did you say that they're not old ancestors and have evolved from that? Or
no, they do. They've got common ancestors. And so, I mean, birds have several things in common. They've got scaled legs, just like a reptile. They lay eggs, very reptilian. So there's several features. And feathers and scales all come from the same component of keratin. So they all are based off the same thing. So there's a lot of similarity. So if you think if I look up TED Talks and a few of the keywords you mentioned, I might be able to find that?
Probably so.
Okay, because I'll start there when I look up this topic.
Okay, yeah, because I was just, you know, if they are, I mean, have birds been around? How long have they been around? Do you know?
Yeah, I don't know off the top of my head in you know, how many millions of years, but it's
a long time.
So
okay,
longer than
well,
me.
I'm just yeah, because I'm fascinated by, you know, if they've been around that long and been around, or have they been around longer than Homo sapiens, humans?
No, birds have been around longer. So yeah,
okay.
So for sure, Homo sapiens. Now, more primitive hominids, we'd have to go back and look at that. But birds date way back. So
yeah, because I'm just fascinated, you know, they've been around that long because our climate has changed a lot from back in this area, you know, in that time period of dinosaurs, because back then the oxygen concentration wasn't as high as it is now. And, but I've just been fascinated by birds for quite some time and really enjoy your show. It's just,
great. Thank you. So
it gives me more to fascinate. Can I ask you one more quick question?
Yeah, before you do, let's you mentioned earlier in your question that you have a lot of or knowledge about breathing in humans.
Yes.
Is that your expertise? Are you in the business of pulmonology or
cardiopulmonary? I'm a heart lung specialist.
Oh, cool. So, okay.
Yeah, I know a lot about people's breathing and I'm just really interested in what I heard her say about birds breathing and how efficient they are and things like that. It was just fascinating to me.
Yeah.
And we have some, you know, the ventilator breathing machines that do some really high tech stuff besides what a lot of people think about when they think about those. And but anyway, it was just fascinating to me, and there's a lot of videos and things that are out there, and I've looked at some of them, and I'm still trying to get my head around it, because it's very, very different than how we breathe. But they've evolved, and they're probably more evolved to deal with a lot of these changes. And I heard you say a little bit earlier in the program, I had just turned it on, that you were talking about some problems that they were having with the climate, or flying into buildings and things like that. But the climate part is really interesting to me as well, because we're having climate challenges, and I've been quite concerned about, and a lot of my colleagues too, beyond what we're hearing in the news so much.
Impacting humans, you're talking about?
Well, just our atmosphere and what we're breathing is really, a lot of people don't realize, but when the humidity gets real high, which is actually due to the dew point, when you get a lot of water vapor in the air, it can actually move out some of the oxygen. There's a formula that you can figure that out. But my question I was going to ask you is the other day when it was really, really, the dew points were really high the other day, I was noticing some of the blue jays that were out here and even a couple of hummingbirds, they seemed to have their beaks open quite a bit.
Yeah.
Is that something they do?
That's
sure.
They're sometimes when a bird has a full crop, they'll have their bill open. The crop is where they're storing food, but you'll also see in the heat of the day in the summer, a lot of birds will open. They'll have their gape open, and they're keeping cool that way as well.
I was wondering if that might be a cooling mechanism.
Yep. And some birds like pelicans and cormorants, they can flutter, flap a skin on their chin. It's called Guler fluttering. And by doing that, they're circulating air in through the mouth and cooling themselves that way. So look up Guler, G-U-L-A-R, fluttering, and you can learn more about how birds keep cool that way. So pretty cool. Okay. Sheila, this has been really interesting. It sounds like almost a Health Matters call, which is another show on this station. But you put the birds into it, so I love it. So thank you very much for the call, Sheila. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Cliff.
Bye-bye. Thanks. Bye.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we go next to John from Fishkill. You called with a question at the beginning, and
Fishville.
You're back now. Fishville. Fishville. Sorry about that.
Well, Fishville is in the center of Louisiana, and we're just out here in the middle of nowhere.
And Fishkill is the lake right next to it where you get your lake, right? Fish, right?
Yeah. Anyway, I'll try not to be too windy. And a question back on the hawks attacking little dogs and picking them at little dogs. Actually, we've lost three, and we're dog people out here. We've probably got 30 or 40 dogs on our homestead. And over the years, in 20 or 30 years, we've lost three little teeny tiny dogs to hawks.
Uh-huh.
But now I've got a neighbor that's got a tiny little 7-pound fluffy little thing, and he won't let her out of his arms.
Yeah.
Now, I told him the other day, I saw advertisements about these harnesses and things you can put on tiny dogs that will stop that attack.
Yeah, where you can, you know, jerk the dog back towards you, that would be good. But as long as your hand's on the leash, I would think that would help.
Well,
but you wouldn't want that the initial attack of a talon going through the abdomen of a dog. That wouldn't go well.
Yeah. Well, these advertisements indicate that this harness that they put on this tiny dog actually has a visual thing that keeps the hawk from coming down.
Huh. Okay, I don't know what that is. I've not seen that product.
Well, I ordered him one of them, and it hadn't come in yet. But,
yeah.
You know, the poor fellow, he can't do anything without that little dog in his hand and his arm.
Well, tell you what, if you get that and it comes in, take a picture of it on the dog for us and send it to us so that we can see that.
Yeah, we'll do that, and hopefully it'll work because, you know, We don't need to lose these little 9-pound fluffy dogs.
No, that's right. That's right.
Plenty of rats and squirrels for those hawks to eat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, Cliff, thanks a lot, man.
Hey, thanks,
Keep
John.
Up the good work.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. Thank you. And we've got one more caller online. JT from Lufkin is on with you, Cliff. What's your question, JT?
Yes, it's JP.
JP.
I wondered if pound for pound, if an adult male cardinal was the most aggressive bird pound for pound, because one day I saw a small male cardinal beat up a hawk in the middle of the air.
I've seen several small birds do the same thing. I've seen red-winged blackbirds, they're cardinal sized, mockingbirds, there's a lot of little birds. I'll tell you what I've seen is a ruby crown kinglet, which is itty bitty, dive bomb a barred owl that was perched. And so all these other birds were mobbing. I'm talking red-bellied woodpeckers, robins, blue jays, all these larger birds. And it was the kinglet, the ruby-crowned kinglet, that was getting in there and getting closest and actually dive-bombing the back of the owl. And I think pound for pound, that was, in my experience, that blew me away, the little bitty ruby crown kinglet. So, but a lot of these birds are, they're mostly being, you know, this time of the year, they're being good parents. They're trying to keep the predator away if there's a nest. And sometimes humans are perceived the predator. So we get a lot of calls from people upset that a, you know, a mockingbird is dive bombing because the nest is right by the back door. Well, try using the front door for a little bit just to let the nesting bird have less stress and raise its young and raise a family like you and I like to do. So I think we need to cut a lot of birds some slack. But you're right. The what you saw with the cardinal being aggressive is it's pretty common out there with a lot of little birds. Yeah. So
thank
cool.
You.
Thank you, JP.
All right. And you've been listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist. And Cliff, at the end of every month, we always have a conservation tip. What do you got for us this month?
Yes, we're going to talk about taking a child to a nature center, refuge, or park in search of nature. Are you tired of seeing your kids or grandkids glued to their electronic devices? Do everyone a favor and take them to a nature center, a refuge, or a park in search of nature. Fresh air and exploring these sorts of sites are good for the body, mind, and soul. If you need gift ideas for children in your life, consider a pair of binoculars, a fishing pole, a plant ID guidebook, and hiking boots to encourage them to keep exploring the great outdoors. Viewing nature is soothing and opens a child's mind to other things around them, especially their plant and animal neighbors. Most American children can identify dozens of symbols, signs, and logos for businesses and products around them, but they can't identify 10 species of plants and animals in their own backyard. Take them to a park, refuge, or nature center and let them get to know some other species around them. The 2005 book, Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder by Richard Louve, L-O-U-V, is a must-read on this topic. Introduce children around you to nature around them. You both will be happier and wiser for it. Do it for the birds.
All right, and you have been listening to Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio and the statewide ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. Thanks again, Cliff, for coming all the way up from Nacogdoches to join us for
this
show.
Thanks, Bill.
You have been listening to Bird Calls, and we want to thank the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for lending us Cliff Shackelford and their expertise. Today's program was made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. This has been Bird Calls from Red River Radio. Our producers for this show are Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford, with phone assistance tonight from Wally Derleth and Sheila Lawrence. The two sound files in tonight's program, profiled species, were from ZeroCanto.org and were recorded by Rob Van, can you pronounce this name for me, Bemelin?
Yes.
Okay. Should have checked that before. Go ahead.
It's ZenoCanto.
ZenoCanto.
ZenoCanto.org.
Right. I don't know what I said there. Anyways, we want to thank Rob Van Bemelin and Simon Elliott for the files. And this month's bird photo was shot by James Childress, who always makes me jealous. And the audio for tonight's program will be posted on our website. And you can tune in at redriverradio.org and listen to this program again. And remember, if you have a photo or a sound clip of a bird and you'd like us to identify it, you can send it to my email address, wbeckett@lsus.edu. That's wbeckett@lsus.edu. Next Tuesday, July 13th, is our next show. And thanks for tuning in.